is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. If we weren't in a pandemic, this would be about the time that Oscar nominations would be announced. We'd be gearing up for a new award season with a new slate of films to catch up on. But the Oscars have been postponed to late April, and instead of going to movie theaters, we're sitting at home binging shows like Bridgerton. But that doesn't mean movies haven't been coming out through all of this. Promising Young Woman, Soul, and The Sound of Metal are just a few of the films released straight to streaming that are now awards contenders. Here to talk through some of those films in this month's pop culture hit list, and yes, to talk Bridgerton too, is Caroline Framke. She's the chief TV critic at Variety. Caroline, great to have you.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Also with us, John Horn. He's the host of KPCC's The Frame and the unofficial vice president of the 1A Movie Club. Jay, John, thanks for being back, for pausing your movie club duties to join us for the hit list again.
Happy to be with you. And as vice president, do I now get to break all tie votes?
No.
Okay. Just asking.
And also with us,
only calm, I guess. Okay.
Jacqueline Coley. She's the awards editor at Rotten Tomatoes. Jacqueline, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. And I'd let John break a tie. That's just me, though.
Oh, thank you.
But I'm the president, so I get to say. No, I'm just kidding. John, yeah, go ahead, break the ties. So let's start with Promising Young Woman. Actress Carey Mulligan plays Cassie, a woman on a revenge mission after the sexual assault of her best friend. And here's a clip from the trailer.
Every week, I go to a club. I act like I'm too drunk to stand. And every week, a nice guy comes over to see if I'm okay.
You okay?
You are so pretty. I am a nice guy.
Are you?
1, 2, 3, 4. I thought we had a connection.
Okay. How old am I? What are my hobbies? What's my name? Sorry, maybe that one's too hard.
Jacqueline, this movie is hard to describe. It's a dark comedy thriller romance at times. Without spoiling, can you tell us a little bit more about the film and what makes it unique?
Yeah, I mean, it says it right there from the title. Carey Mulligan plays Cassie, and she was a medical student. And at the time, I guess they were in medical school, her best friend was assaulted in a similar situation. She was, you know, drunk at a party. And it's one of those situations where when she goes to authorities, no one believes her. And the movie, yes, it's about revenge. And yes, it has a very dark subplot. But also, Emeril Forel, if folks understand Killing Eve, will recognize that she really loves putting very sort of dark themes with, I would say, like a candy coated sort of outside. And that's really what I think is the best part of this film. And yes, there's a certain aspect that is revenge, but really, it's a movie about grief. And the extents that people will go to get away from grief and sort of dismiss it when instead of dealing with it. And although it is funny and has an incredible soundtrack and an incredible performance by Carey Mulligan, it also is, I think, a very poignant sort of story about women and grief and how to move on. It's produced by Margot Robbie. And actually, we were watching it almost to the day it premiered this time last year at Sundance, back when we could all be in a room with other people and see movies together. So it's kind of a bittersweet moment for me, but I'm so glad that folks are able to see it.
John, what about you? What's your take on the film?
I mean, I think it's a really interesting film. I mean, it is looking at, I mean, the conceit of the film is that Carey Mulligan plays a character who pretends to be drunk in bars. And guys, as guys will unfortunately typically do, hit on her and knowing that she's incapacitated, you know, take her home and try to have sex with her. And she's not drunk at all. She's sober. So part of it is about how men take advantage of women who are not sober. And that is not something that this film creates. That's something that is, you know, true and happens repeatedly. So it starts from a place of, you know, real life. And then it goes into, you know, this darker revenge story, but also about empowerment. I would say it's not so much a revenge story as it is a story about grief and about kind of becoming a whole person. Carey Mulligan's character is deeply scarred. We don't really know exactly what happens when these people come to her house. Let's just say it's not all good. But it is a really provocative film, and I found it really terrifying. And I also thought it made a very good point. You know, if you're in a bar and see somebody who is incapacitated, help them. Don't take advantage of them. I mean, that's something that every kid needs to learn, high school, college, you name it. These are people who are vulnerable and they shouldn't be exploited.
Well, we got this message from Camille in Syracuse.
A movie I recently watched that impacted me greatly was A Woman in Pieces on Netflix. It was about a woman who gave birth, had a home birth, and lost the baby. And it was just such a compelling movie with really, really raw emotions. For the first time in a very long time, I found myself unable to take my eyes away from the screen. With a lot of superficial TV shows, this was something completely different. And as a new mother, it greatly impacted me and also gave me a deeper understanding of fellow moms out there who cope with loss.
Now, Promising Young Woman was released in theaters and then in a limited way on streaming services weeks later. Pieces of a Woman was released straight onto Netflix. Jacqueline, do those choices affect these movies' status as award contenders at all?
Typically, there has been this perception, perhaps, in the Academy that there is a bias towards streaming giants like Netflix. They came up short with Roma a few years ago, which a lot of folks had pegged it to be their sort of best picture winner. But I think this season in particular, a lot of folks, including myself, have dubbed it the streaming season, the Netflix season. It's actually an advantage where a lot of the more traditional studios are a little bit behind the eight ball with how they market these films, how they get them in front of voters. Netflix, which has always operated in this mindset, is ahead of the game, and Pieces of a Woman is just one of many available titles that Netflix has in the conversation this year. So I would say in a normal year, perhaps, but this year I would say it's actually an advantage to be at a streaming giant like Netflix or Amazon.
Well, another awards contender that was recently released to streaming is Disney Pixar's Soul. And this is an animated movie about Joe Gardner. He's a middle school band teacher and jazz musician. His trip to the afterlife and his mission to reconnect his soul to his body. Let's listen to the trailer.
Is this heaven?
No, it's the great before.
This is where new souls get their personalities, quirks, and interests before they go to Earth.
Meet 22.
I don't want to go to Earth.
Stop fighting this.
I don't want to.
John, what was your take on Soul?
It got me thinking about a lot of things. I was watching a documentary the other day that's going to play at the Sundance Film Festival. It's about a band called Sparks. It's a great documentary called The Sparks Brothers. And they're talking about rock music in the 1980s. And they said there were two kinds of songs then. One, I Want to Have Sex with You. Two, Don't Shut This Party Down. And there's another saying about movies. There's only two kinds of movies. Hero goes on a journey and stranger comes to town. And Pixar specializes, and Pete Docter, who co-wrote and directed Soul, really understands the hero goes on a journey story. And generally, those are internal journeys. They're not always external. He made Up. He made Inside Out. He was a writer on WALL-E. This is a story about, and I can't think of a movie that's better timed to the pandemic, about who you are and what you need to be and how you judge yourself. Pete Docter said after he made Inside Out, and I'm quoting him now, he said, I realize that as wonderful as these projects are, there's more to living than a singular passion. Sometimes the small, insignificant things are what it's really about. So this is a story about a jazz musician who thinks he has the greatest gig ever, has a little street accident, ends up in this kind of before life, afterlife place, and starts to understand, along with a lot of other people, who it is he's born to be and needs to become, and how you measure your own value in society. I mean, it's in many ways a deeply religious film. I was looking at reviews this morning, and you know, critics like Christianity Today and National Catholic Reporter are just as excited about this film as, you know, places like Variety and The Hollywood Reporter.
Well, Caroline, coming from the world of TV, what has it been like to see big budget films like Soul premiere along, you know, these bingeable series? Are we just going to get spoiled by having so many options we can access from our couch?
Yeah, I have to say, it's not totally surprising to me. I feel like having watched a bunch of streaming stuff from, you know, 2013, when Netflix kind of first became its thing with House of Cards and Orange is the New Black, it was always pretty clear that streaming was going to make a big push for, you know, the biggest talent, the biggest budgets, etc. So there is something, obviously the pandemic ushered that in and made it more obvious that movies were about to crash on in a bigger way. But coming from the TV world, I'm not totally surprised to see that Streaming is making the bigger play all around.
Coming up, we go from movies to television. Netflix doubles down on its romantic offering, and Disney gets a little weird with WandaVision.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo explains the importance of creating a safe space for therapy.
I can't tell you how many times I've had clients that say that expression, like, I've never told that to anybody. That's when I know I've made some kind of momentous move with this person. They feel safe enough to expose that part of themselves, and doing that together with somebody else can be very powerful.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
We are still in the middle of this pandemic, and right now, having science news you can trust, from variants to vaccines, is essential. NPR Shortwave has your back. About 10 minutes every weekday, listen and subscribe to Shortwave, the daily science podcast from NPR.
You're listening to The Hit List. It's our monthly pop culture roundup. So, Caroline, we have to talk about Bridgerton. This series comes from Netflix and Shonda Rhimes of Scandal and Grey's Anatomy fame. It follows a large cast of characters in 19th century England. There's some romance, some sex, some drama, lots of corsets. Let's play some of the trailer now.
All is fair in love and war.
Miss Daphne Bridgerton!
You have no idea what it is to have one's entire life reduced to a single moment.
The time has come for the social season.
Tighter! She to breathe, Mama!
My name is Lady Whistledown. You do not know me, but I know you.
So, Caroline, this has been a wildly popular show. What do you think is drawing so many people to it?
Well, I think it came at exactly the right time. You know, my job is to analyze television, but I'm only human. And by December, I was exhausted like everyone else. And when I finally got to see this, you know, it came out on Christmas, but I got to see it a little earlier. I was so genuinely grateful for something this fun and swoony and beautiful to look at. You know, it was just fun to get lost in that world. So I think that it came at a time when people wanted something a little bit easy, a little bit fun, romantic, and something that would just go quickly. I think I watched it in a day, and that doesn't often happen to me.
I think I stretched it out over a weekend. I was very disappointed to reach the end of it, but I was like, man, you could have given it at least a week, you know, but
I'm impressed.
It was a weekend. John, this is part of a broader play by Netflix to lean into the romance genre. They've seen a lot of success with its YA romance offerings, and thinking of, you know, The Kissing Booth to All the Boys I've Loved Before. How is Netflix doing right now? And what offerings is it gravitating toward?
They're doing incredibly well. I mean, they just came out with earnings. They surpassed 200 million subscribers worldwide. They have, you know, lived heavily on debt to finance all of their productions. They say that in this coming year, they won't have to borrow any more money, which is a milestone for them financially. They also said that they have, I think, 500 shows in post-production right now. So while networks, the traditional networks, are kind of quickly running out of content, Netflix, because it has to release shows in so many different languages, is kind of working almost a year ahead of other networks. They have a huge bank of content. I mean, I can't imagine that they are, you know, they've ever been better positioned. And obviously, there's a lot of new competitors like Disney Plus. Paramount's launching its new streaming service. There's Apple, there's HBO Max. But I think Bridgerton is a good example of Netflix saying, we are going to be open to strong creative ideas. And Queen's Gambit is another great example, the Scott Frank series about chess. I mean, I'm friends with Scott, and I sent him an email the other day about his success. And he said, I was standing on the set of this series saying, nobody will ever watch this. What am I doing? But Netflix believed in it. And I'm going to throw out another example, Mon Rainey's Black Bottom. That was set up at HBO. HBO was worried about how much it was going to cost. They didn't want to pay what the producers thought it needed. Netflix said, we'll double the budget if you want to make it here. And they did. And now it's a contender for Best Picture. So I think Netflix is saying, we are going to give creative talent a wide berth. And if they want to create a show like Bridgerton, if they want to do a chess series like Queen's Gambit, if they want to do a play like Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, we're going to let them do it because we think the audience is there for it. Mm-hmm. And because there's so many subscribers, people can find what they want and things take off. I mean, I'm sure they didn't expect either Bridgerton or Queen's Gambit to do as well as they did. But talk about horses for courses. I mean, they came out at just the right time when people wanted something that made them feel good.
Well, Anne emailed us, Bridgerton, OMG, absolutely the best. I've watched it 3 times. Caroline, one thing that sets this series apart from other period dramas is its diverse cast. And this isn't just colorblind casting. The race of the characters is part of the story, albeit a small one. And you wrote a little bit about this in your review of the show for Variety. Explain that.
Yeah, I will admit that when I first started the show, I thought that the inclusivity of including, you know, prominent Black characters was a colorblind casting situation. Shonda Rhimes is known for doing that in all her shows. But as you said, there is a moment a few episodes in where Adjoa Ando's Lady Danbury is talking to her nephew, played by Regé Jean Page. He's the Duke of Hastings. And she mentions that they can't take what they have for granted because they didn't always have it, and it's only because the queen, who is Black and played by Golda Rushavel, married the white king and sort of elevated all the Black people in the kingdom. And then that's kind of all we hear about it for the rest of the season, which I was surprised by, and I really think that in a second season, which they have just announced is officially happening to no one's surprise, I really think they need to dig into that more, having brought it up, because that's a rather huge implication that this one royal interracial marriage solved racism? Question mark.
Well, you know, another thing that makes Bridgerton different than other costume dramas is that there isn't this sort of Pride and Prejudice style slow burn where it's all about pent-up desire and restraint. You know, it's the pinky fingers brushing against each other. The romance and the sex all happen, and then they happen some more. And the show is pretty steamy. Caroline, why do you think Rhimes chose to break that convention?
Well, these are adapted from Julia Quinn's Regency romance novels, which obviously have roots in the Austen sort of trope tradition, but are really their own animal. The romance novel of it all really makes it so that, yeah, the sex is pretty front and center. And I was pretty excited to see that. We've obviously, if you've watched Scandal, Grey's Anatomy, sex is a part of it, but it is under broadcast network constrictions. So in the Netflix show, which is created by Scandal producer Chris Van Dusen, they can be more explicit about it. They can be more in your face a little bit. And I will confess to, even as I was expecting sex to be a part of the show because it's on Netflix and they have the ability to do that, I was surprised by how explicit it was. I had thought maybe this would be something I'd watch with my parents at some point, and I don't think that will be happening ever. They can watch it on their own. That's fine. That was surprising to me.
Well, Disney Plus have recently released WandaVision. This is a new TV series that follows Marvel's superheroes Wanda Maximoff and Vision. And here's the trailer from that.
Wanda and Vision, aren't we a five pair?
This is our home now. I want us to fit in.
Oh, this is gonna be a gas!
Where did you two move from? How long have you been married, and why don't you have children yet?
Our story.
I think what my wife means to say is that we moved from...
Moved from where? Married when? Damn it, why?
Oh, Arthur, stop it. Stop it. Stop it. Stop it.
Caroline, talk about WandaVision. It's kind of trippy.
It's very trippy. It's a fascinating first TV show to come out of Marvel Studios, which it is, technically. It puts Wanda and Vision in a bunch of different sort of sitcom homages. The first couple episodes are very Dick Van Dyke, Bewitched, and the third one, which came out last week, was a little bit more Brady Bunch. But all the while, they know they're superheroes, but they live in this world, they're married, there are nosy neighbors. It's very strange, and it's very purposefully not telling us why they're there or what's going on yet. And with episodes being released weekly versus all at once, like Netflix does, the mystery is going to be dragged out a little bit longer. And one thing I find really interesting about the show, even aside from the actual show itself, like I said, it's the first TV show from Marvel Studios. And before the pandemic, I do believe that was supposed to be Falcon and the Winter Soldier, starring Anthony Mackie and Sebastian Stan's characters from the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which will probably be a much more straight-up superhero show. So I am not sure that this was the plan for this to be the first offering, but I think it's a much more interesting one because we have a lot of television shows coming from Disney, Marvel, Star Wars, the whole conglomerate, dozens coming our way. And from where I'm sitting, if they can be this weird and take these chances and really set themselves apart from the movies, I think that's the way to go.
Jacqueline, I've really been enjoying this series, and I just love the way they've leaned into some of the TV conventions of each, sort of genre that they move through down to the laugh track. How are you feeling about the show?
Actually, one of the things I really love about it is it harkens back to a show from the 90s on HBO that I'm dating myself a little bit called Dream On, where it really sort of, it's always in on the joke and it feels like it's always just a fourth break wall away, but these are superheroes. And I just love that sort of like peanut butter and chocolate combination. You didn't know how the 50s nostalgia throwback of like Leave It to Beaver would play when you have these superheroes, and it works so well. You think to yourself, why didn't we think of doing something this weird previous to that. The other thing which is great with this is because it's a Marvel television show and they were able to sort of bring it into a very small scope, they're also able to bring in other folks from the MCU in as sort of guest stars. We have Monica Rambeau, which is Tiana Paris, so she'll be in the next Captain Marvel film. You have Kat Dennings coming back from Thor fame, and also Randall Park, who played the FBI agent from Ant-Man. And so it's just another example of Marvel weaving this tapestry of the MCU across all platforms and really showing how they can continue to tell these stories after Endgame, and they will just continue to build this world out and, you know, keep cashing in those toy and merchandising dollars that come with it, and Disney will keep on churning.
We're discussing the latest film and television releases in this edition of our monthly pop culture hit list. Paul tweets, looking forward to Netflix February release of Jenny and Georgia. That's a mom and daughter relationship series. Cop tweets, Close Enough and Barry are probably my favorite things right now, both on HBO Max. Janet tweets, The Great on Hulu is an incredible romp, like nothing I've ever seen before. That's another costume drama. And Angie tweets, Sylvie's Love was my favorite drama movie. I hope it also gets nominated. And we'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo explains the importance of creating a safe space for therapy.
I can't tell you how many times I've had clients that say that expression, like, I've never told that to anybody. That's when I know I've made some kind of momentous move with this person. They feel safe enough to expose that part of themselves, and doing that together with somebody else can be very powerful.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
If you're never quite sure how to answer the question,
where are you from?
NPR's Rough Translation might be the podcast for you.
Yes, finally, someone else.
Give us your accents and your origin stories, your cross-cultural misfits, yearning to just be, and listen to Rough Translation on NPR.
This is 1A. Now, The Sound of Metal recently came out on Amazon Prime, and the movie follows a heavy metal drummer played by Riz Ahmed, who begins to lose his hearing.
Your hearing is deteriorating rapidly.
We'll come back. Till then, Lou, we just keep going, okay?
No.
Lou, no. Let's play tomorrow. Let's see what it's like, okay? I'm gonna be like a click track. You can play to me.
Do you understand me? I can't. I'm deaf.
Jacqueline, what did you think of The Sound of Metal?
Well, The Sound of Metal is another film that was part of the sort of strange festival season of last year. And I actually got to catch it at the Toronto Film Festival 2 years ago, I guess now, but now it's coming out on Amazon. It stars Riz Ahmed as a drummer losing his hearing. And what's really interesting about this film is this is not somebody who had this big aspirations in life. This was a man who just wanted to be a drummer in a band, and this disability coming upon him late in life really changes everything around him. It changes his relationships. It changes what he maybe wants to do with the rest of his life. And in the center of it, what's interesting is his willfulness, I will say, for how he doesn't want to face the reality of what is happening to him and how he looks to sort of bargain and beg his way into a different situation. And it isn't until he comes across an advisor at a camp that he goes to learn American Sign Language and sort of learn how to live this new existence with a disability where he really sort of embraces who he is. It has some really interesting sound cues in it. I think it is my hands down pick for best sound this year because of the way they use it in the storytelling to sort of tell the story of his diminished hearing and also essentially how he's listening in and out of his life. And it's a really incredible performance by Riz Ahmed, also Olivia Cooke, and Paul Racy, who's actually a CODA. He is the child of deaf or hearing impaired parents, and he knows American Sign Language, a character actor from several years, and he is getting a ton of praise for his performance in this one, which I'm so happy to see sort of like a journeyman have his moment. It harkens me back to sort of Robert Forrester with Jackie Brown and sort of that. So it's a really incredible thing.
And what are we hearing about Riz Ahmed's performance?
Yeah, and Riz Ahmed, they're definitely talking best actor for him. He recently came out on the cover, I think it was a Variety or Hollywood Reporter, where he was saying, you know, he's had to play these roles that he didn't want to do anymore. He said, I'm done playing terrorists. I want to have an opportunity to have three-dimensional characters. And so to see a South Asian British person play this role where that is a part of the character but not all of the character, and seeing him really struggle with the realities of this disability is really incredible and visceral. It is one of the best male performances of this year. It is just a shame that it goes up against so many performances that are going to be hard to beat, most particularly Chadwick Boseman and the lead actor performance of Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. But I think he's going to give him a run for his money, even in a posthumous awards campaign.
Well, we got this message from Barbara in Massachusetts.
While we're enjoying many of the new films that are available via streaming, very early on in the pandemic, we cut up numbers, went to 100, put them in a hat, and every Saturday night we pick one out. The numbers correspond to the AFI Top 100 films. Some of them we've seen before, some of them are new, some are wonderful, some make us wonder how they made the list, but that's what passes for entertainment during COVID.
Barbara, that is a heck of a strategy. Now, she's talking about the American Film Institute's list of top 100 movies of all time. Jacqueline, you work at Rotten Tomatoes, which aggregates reviews and provides ratings for various movies and shows based on those reviews. Do you think more people are using Rotten Tomatoes in the way we just heard described to try to figure out what's worth their time?
Absolutely. It was actually one of the strange situations of the pandemic in the sense that the minute theaters were sort of shut down was actually, and last year was one of the biggest years on the site ever, because what people started to realize when they were at home and they had more time to maybe consume content is it is like a bargain bin of incredible film and TV shows, and they needed guidance. And that's really what Rotten Tomatoes prides itself as. And so they're able to go there and see what the critics say with our critics' consensus. But we actually just launched a new feature called Audience Says, where we actually aggregate also the audience reviews so that that way they, whatever is sort of the audience consensus, can also be put forth with that. And yeah, we have seen a huge uptick with folks checking us out for film content, but also for a ton of television content. And we have this huge binge guide section, which is now one of the most popular areas on the site, because it's not saying that everybody wants to find a film that's 91% certified fresh on the tomato meter. How people use our site as a tool and a resource, I'm always surprised by it. I have folks come up to me every day and say, oh, I need a film that's in that 70-80 range, because that means some folks didn't like it, and that means that that's the best type of film or television, the ones that not everybody is about. And you have some people that are like, I don't even look at the critical reception. I just want to look at the audience score. That is the only guidance that I use. And I think that's why it's such a great platform and resource, because we have so many options, but you do need guidance. I mean, I literally do this for a living and it's hard to keep up with it. So I don't know how a mom of four trying to figure out what on Disney Plus she should watch this weekend is going to do it without resources like that.
Well, Caroline, I also wonder about fatigue. I was having a conversation with a friend of mine about how we're both just having trouble this far into the pandemic being excited about anything. I agree with you. Bridgerton brought sort of this welcome breath of fresh air. But are we also sort of getting to this place of streaming fatigue?
I mean, I can speak personally, and yeah, I mean, I'm tired. I would love to have other things to do, but for the foreseeable future, it doesn't seem like that's it. But I think that's why something like Bridgerton, something like Queen's Gambit, when it does sort of hit in that way where you can find other people talking about it, I think that actually is making the conversation last longer than it might have before. Because one thing that I think, you know, is missing from streaming conversations usually is that they'll release the whole season, there'll be like a week of talking about it, and then it'll be the next show. But something I'm really interested in with Bridgerton especially is that, you know, we're talking about it over a month after it was released, and that's not usually the case for a Netflix show. So I think there is a bit more of a chance for things to find legs and keep their spot in the conversation, because what else are we going to do?
Well, Christina tweets this: I thought Sound of Metal was artfully done. I appreciate the positive light shown on deaf culture. John, the pandemic might have ended awards season as we know it, but we've been having this discussion about whether award shows like the Oscars are still relevant for years now. How does that question strike you today?
I mean, I think it's a good question. And by the way, if you're fatigued by streaming, play a board game. My wife and I both watch a lot of movies for work. Every night I'm pitching like Wingspan or Ticket to Ride, Hearts, Yahtzee, you name it. So if you're fatigued by TV, sit down with your family and play a board game. The most important thing I think that Oscars serve is, you know, yes, it's good for a studio or a filmmaker to get the hardware, but it's to call attention to a film, I think, that otherwise might have been overlooked or underlooked. So the way that the Oscars and the nominations can elevate a film, you know, it could be Roma, it could be The Shape of Water, it could be a movie that is not really mainstream, Birdman, you name it. I think that's where the most important role is for the Academy and for the awards. And the good thing is this year, a lot of the things that are contending are, you know, maybe a little bit below the radar because the studios aren't part of that game. The question is, will it have that kind of impact? Because the TV audience is going to be dramatically smaller than it would be. That, to me, is the best role that, you know, any award show serves. The SAG Awards, the Academy Awards, the Directors Guild Awards, they elevate works that are worth paying attention to. And I got to just say one thing we haven't mentioned. We've talked so much about scripted. There are some great documentaries that are streaming right now. And I would encourage everybody to check out Dick Johnson is Dead, which is a documentary by Kirsten Johnson about her father. It sounds grim. It's not. It's very funny, even though it's about dying. I would recommend 76 Days, which is a documentary about being inside Wuhan hospitals during the first outbreak of the pandemic. And then I would really recommend a movie called Assassins, which is about the two women who killed Kim Jong-un in the Malaysian airport with the nerve agent. I don't know if you remember that story. Mm-hmm. What really happened is even crazier than the way that this person was assassinated. So it doesn't always have to be scripted. Dick Johnson is Dead, Netflix, also Crypt Camp. 76 Days Film is where you can find 76 Days, and then Assassins, which is on a number of streaming sites like YouTube and iTunes.
Well, you got this email from Rafi who says, when Rotten Tomatoes has a 100% rating, it just means that the critics liked it more than they didn't like it. So if every critic barely liked the movie more than they didn't like it, it would get 100%. Jacqueline, is that how the rating system works?
Oh, Lord. You know, he's right, but it's a very simplified thing. Look, the tomato meter, and I talk about it a lot, and trust me when I say this, when I go to Sundance and I'm like, hi, I'm Jacqueline from Rotten Tomatoes, people are never shy with their opinions. They love coming and telling me this information. And I'm like, yes, but it's a snapshot, and that's what it's meant to be. That's all that it's meant to be. It's be a snapshot of what the critics who were able and available to see that film at that time say about that movie. But there are hundreds, if not thousands, of films that we get to re-examine through the lens of sort of hindsight that have totally changed their perspective. their perception. The Meg Ryan movie, and is it Into the Cut, where he goes down on her? Like, that movie has had a completely different lifespan the second time around. And then acclaimed movies that folks look in a different lens, something like Gone with the Wind. That's what I like about Rotten Tomatoes, because we've actually done archival projects where we're able to find contemporary Black critics who were writing about Gone with the Wind when it was in theaters, and their opinions are now on the tomato meter. We have, I think, our earliest review that's on Rotten Tomatoes goes back to 1898 and one of the very first movies to ever be out there. And we have fun with it ourselves. I mean, I host a podcast on Rotten Tomatoes called Rotten Tomatoes Is Wrong, literally, where we dissect whether or not a film like Blade should have gotten the 56% rating that it had when it was reviewed in 1998. With the knowledge of hindsight, we can say that we can't get to WandaVision. We cannot get to the MCU without them taking risk with comic book movies in 1998. That is a hard R horror hybrid comic book movie that you can make a direct line to the Western that Logan was when Mangold did that one, or the heist movie that they were able to do with Ant-Man. This is why I think it's incredible to have a tool like Rotten Tomatoes out there, and really why I really love working at the website. And, you know, it's okay. 100% or zero. We'll talk about it.
That's Jacqueline Coley. She's the awards editor at Rotten Tomatoes. Also with us for the hit list, our vice president, John Horn, host of The Frame from KPCC, and Caroline Framke, chief TV critic at Variety. Thanks to you all. And they have some additional recommendations for you, and we'll tweet them out at 1A. Today's producer was Arfi Getty, and our podcast is produced by Barb Anguiano. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk more soon. This is 1A.